Thanks for those introductory words. My name is Will Firth. I'm the translator of Dolazak, which we have before us as The Coming. Can you hear me well enough?
It doesn't work, I think. It's not on.
It seems to be on.
Yes.
Okay, and we're very glad that Andre has been able to make it tonight. Just briefly, I discovered this book in 2010, shortly after it had been written, shortly after I'd met Andre at the book fair in Leipzig. And I was on the lookout for a Montenegrin contribution to the anthology, Best European Fiction. So I sort of searched the internet a bit and came across the website of the Carver Association. And what struck me most was the cover picture on Dolazak of this, I don't know how many of you know it, of a cross on the top of a hill that's been blasted by snow. It looked just so dramatic, and I thought, this must be an interesting book. And I got in touch with Andre, ordered the book, and the content was just as stunning as the picture. So I'm very glad that I embarked on this task, and I'm very glad that the book has finally been published. I don't know how many of you know about Andre's background. You were born in 1974.
Yeah, in Sarajevo.
In Sarajevo, but spent a large part of your childhood both in Montenegro and in Bosnia, is
yes,
that correct?
Yes, 2 years in Montenegro, and then we went back to Bosnia.
Mm-hmm. In 92, is that right?
Oh. No, no, in 92 we came back to Montenegro again.
And I just wanted to ask briefly about your Greek surname, because a lot of people wonder, you know. That was your grandfather paternally, wasn't it?
Yeah. First of all, I'm very sorry for being late. Thank you very much for being patient, but after all, wasn't that hell of a coming or what? my grandfather was a Greek, and in some strange way I am partly, but I don't speak Greek actually, even my father doesn't speak it, so we lost the knowledge of Greek language, and that's probably the biggest fortune we lost during last century, yeah? Because I think it would be very nice to know, after all, even a few words of Greek language, but what to say. I don't think that Greek identity formed me in any way.
Well, you at least know enough Greek to enlighten me. You told me in Leipzig that the word apocalypse means lifting the veil in Greek. And I wanted to ask you, the coming has been described as a mixture of a detective novel and an apocalyptic novel. That sounds just like negativeness, concentrated negativeness. But the novel is tense and dark, that's true. But the idea of the apocalypse is not necessarily something negative, not purely negative. It lifts the veil. It shows us things that may have been hidden or concealed. What made you choose the theme of the apocalypse for your novel?
Yeah, of course, that word has its Greek origin, and it means a shifting of the wheel, which means that it's kind of a showing of the truth, and that's the point of the apocalypse. After that, anything won't be the same, because truth is more or less unbearable. But do you know that the opposite of apocalypto, which means shifting of the wheel, is eucalypto, which means which means hidden. I read it at Derrida. I don't speak Greek.
That's interesting. And
so in order to fight anxiety about a coming apocalypse, we should chew Wrigley's Orbite eucalyptus chewing gums.
And I also wanted to ask now at the beginning, to what extent the novel is autobiographical. I know there are some references to Ulcin, where you spent part of your childhood and your adulthood, for example, hunting ducks on the frozen salt pans in Ulcin. Is there any
That's fiction.
Truth in
I like.
Okay. And there's a strong Austrian component, because one of the protagonists is a young man in a mental institution in Austria who spent his childhood in Vienna. What's your interest in Austria?
Thomas Bernhard is my major reference in literature. My favorite writer, I will any time put him above any other writer, above all writers. that was my way to pay tribute to him. After all, I'm paying tribute to him in at least four of my novels, but that's that Austrian component. I mean, the matter of the truth and the matter of apocalypse are omnipresent in my books, I would say, because I had my own apocalypse in 1992. I mean, from where I stand, in my opinion, what happened in Bosnia was shifting off the wheel from the face of the former Yugoslavia, you know. I think Rilke said that art is the last wheel on the face of the horror. And other wise writers said that we have art only to bear us from the truth. I mean, what happened in 1992 was an apocalyptical moment for me, and after that, obviously, nothing was same for me. And as you know, how it goes in literature, you don't necessarily write about Bosnia if you want to write about Bosnia. So, in many ways, The Coming is a novel about my Bosnian experience, about my war experience.
What I find fascinating, though, is that it's not just the lifting of the veil on the face of horror at a political or social level, but also the individuals in the novel are sort of suddenly put before the prospects of, I don't know, I mean, that they see all of the mistakes they've made in their lives, or they see, you know, they have to do everything that they still want to do this evening before the apocalypse comes. It's a very personal thing as well, isn't it?
Yes, of course. I mean, I don't know. I think there is a thin line between literature and ideology, you know. And if you want to preserve yourself from being a writer of ideological pamphlet, you have to put it really personal, from my opinion. That's where I stand. When you are talking in the first person, writing in the first person narrative, everything works. At the moment when I choose so-called kako je sveznajući pripovjedač, what would be the word for sveznajući pripovjedač, pripovjedač koji
sveznaje, a narrator who binds everything together. No, what do you mean?
Kish wrote about that. Mm-hmm. He wrote against that kind of literature, you know.
Yes, I suppose if you expect that with Dolazak, you're going to be disappointed, because there are lots of open ends in it, and you have to imagine what's going to happen. I think maybe at this stage it might be good to read an excerpt from the first chapter. This is the one that was published in Best European Fiction as well. We've mentioned one of the protagonists being a young man in Austria. The other protagonist is a detective in Ulcin. So he speaks about the beginning of his career. When I first rented an office in the centre of town, I furnished it minimally but tastefully by anyone's standards. Posters of classic old movies went up on the walls. The Maltese Falcon with Humphrey Bogart, Chinatown with Jack Nicholson. The posters were to discreetly prompt clients to compare me with the best. A little pretentious, I admit, but it proved effective. A massive oaken desk dominated the room. Period furniture was installed to give clients the impression that they were engaging a company with traditional standards. And people still believe in tradition, although tradition always betrays them if they don't betray it first. The desk sported a black Mercedes typewriter, a real antique and pure extravagance. I wanted everyone who came in to know that we didn't allow any newfangled gadgets like computers in our firm. I wanted clients to know that our methods were time-tested. A detective needs to seem timeless. I wanted people to think, wow, this is a hard-boiled, old-school detective who can be a real tough guy where necessary, a Sam Spade sort of character, who's seen a lot and knows the mean streets but isn't afraid to jump back into the thick of things if circumstances require. As soon as I opened my agency, though, it seems all of Ulcin decided to start killing, robbing, abducting and raping. And there was plenty of adultery too. It must be close to a dozen marriages I've torn apart. I'll always remember those jobs most fondly, given the rest of my blood-soaked career. I follow the adulterers to their hotel, make myself comfortable in my car, and knock back a swig or two of whiskey, just enough to give them time to undress and get down to business. A few photographs as evidence, and the matter is settled. My own experience in such matters is rather scant, I should say, or at least not as extensive as I'd have liked it to be. But one thing's for certain. Women cope with adultery much better. A woman sees her partner's adultery as a betrayal. She's angry and offended. But a man who's just found out his wife is cheating on him sees it as a humiliation and irrefutable proof that he's not man enough. When a woman finds out she's been cheated on, her femininity is abruptly heightened. It's as if she has a kind of femininity switch, which her husband inadvertently activates by having an affair. But a cheated man crumbles like a used condom. Little in this world is as fragile as masculinity. I've learnt that lesson well. Another thing which quickly became clear to me, whether I'm solving serious crimes like murder or crimes of the heart, as one romantically inclined and to my delight promiscuous lady client once described adultery, the most important thing is to understand what the client wants. The ones who hire me to find out if their partner is cheating on them thirst for evidence that their suspicions are justified. If a wife is cheating on her husband, she's a bitch. If she isn't cheating on him, he's a swine for suspecting her. Faced with the choice between a negative image of her and a negative image of himself, he always chooses the former. Each of us obviously has unlimited potential for swinishness. Whether and in what form that potential comes out is just a minor technical detail. So I always make a point of presenting extensive evidence of adultery. A photo montage works wonders, irrespective of whether the said adultery actually took place. If it didn't, it still could have. So in a way, I'm communicating a deeper truth. And after all, the client comes first. If the client is satisfied, my own satisfaction is assured. Things are more complicated with murder. To generalize a little, I'd say there are two kinds of murder investigation clients. There are those who want to know who committed the murder, and those who want to know why. With the latter, it's easy. You have a chat with them. When they drop in to inquire how the investigation's going, you invite them down to a local bar. People loosen up after a drink. Sooner or later, they'll give you a hint as to their suspicions, and then the case is as good as cracked. From then on, you just confirm the story they themselves have come up with. Tell them you're close to solving the case, but make them wait a bit longer. For some reason, people consider what they call arriving at the truth to be a thankless job. The truth is a hard road, several clients have said. But those who want to know who the murderer was are hard to please. They usually want to take revenge, so you can't just point a finger at the first passerby. It usually ends up that after trying to resolve the case for a little, I give up, cancel the contract, and just ask them to cover my expenses. The way people think is to a detective's advantage. Tell them any old story and they'll exclaim, "I knew it!" Whatever tale you tell, even if it's got as many holes as Swiss cheese, people will say, "Yes, it's logical." There's evidence for everything. All you need is a story to back it up. But, excuse me, by way of illustration, let's take the World Cup football final. A penalty shootout will decide who gets to be world champion. The last shot is taken by the best player on the planet. Whether he scores or misses, people will say, "I knew it," because it's logical that the best player will score when it's hardest, just as it's logical that the best player will miss in a decisive moment because, as we know, fate is often unkind. My point is that a detective's work isn't so much about finding out the truth as inventing a story which people will accept as the truth. It's not about discovering the truth, but about discovering what truth is for those people. Truth always appears as a fiction and takes the form of a story. I am a storyteller, says the detective.
Yeah, obviously, he's very cynical.
That's fairly typical of the novel, I think. A lot of witty, intelligent cynicism coupled with funny bits or sort of expressions like Swiss cheese and so on. They're very enjoyable to translate and hard in parts as well.
The idea was to put in contrast a cynical father and the idealistical son. which is very funny in a mental hospital in Austria. But no one really knows why is he there, because he's obviously very intelligent, and his way of seeing things is for us, for the reader, and even for me, the writer, more acceptable than the father's one. So that's the irony. We have two takes on the same murder, which takes place at the very beginning of the novel, and that contrapunct is the way that novel works, between father and the son, between cynicism and idealism.
Yes, I don't know if it's giving away too much, but the idealism is coupled with a kind of religiosity, if you like. The son is impassioned by stories of medieval mystics, and he finds out about this book that is buried in the old Jewish graveyard in Ulzin, and so there's this whole other level, sort of more sensitive, more dreamy or religious, if you like, and yeah, they sort of come together.
Yeah, we have an escalation of idealism, and then that idealism becomes really dangerous. That's obvious in the book. So at the very end, one should wonder, should we accept cynicism or that kind of dangerous idealism? So I tried to paint a picture with many shades of grey, not a black and white picture. You know. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any questions at this stage? Otherwise, I'm going to do that. One of the things I found interesting about this novel is that André wrote a soundtrack at the end of the pieces of music or the songs that he'd listened to while writing it, and he's done it with his most recent novel, Paresia, as well. What role does music play in your literary production?
It is very important for my life, not only literature.
Okay.
I listen to music all the time. I find it very hard to sleep if I'm not listening to music, you know.
Listen to music when you go to sleep?
Yeah, of course. Okay.
And all night long?
No. Well, I fell asleep, so I don't know what's going on
after
that.
But the music's still playing.
I put the iPod on shuffle and it plays
all night long.
My novel Mimesis is it has 10 chapters, and all of those chapters is named by a pop song. I have a soundtrack in The Sun, soundtrack in The Coming, and a playlist in my latest novel, which is yet not, which is in the pre-press right now. I don't know. I always thought that my thoughts and my writing communicates with the things I write, see, and listen. You know, and I always try to put many references on the books I'm reading, movies I'm watching, and the music I'm listening. So that's my world, you know. That's my world.
There are lots of references to your world, to real events, to imagined events as well. But I wanted to just ask about the article you wrote in January, the controversial article, if you like, which referred to a Bosnian Serb in Republika Srpska smuggling guns and explosives into the building in Banja Luka shortly before the Republika Srpska's 20th anniversary celebrations in January. And he was caught and put into investigative custody, probably charged, I don't know.
No, he was released.
So was he released?
He was released, and there is no charge for terrorism, of course, which we knew at the very first moment.
Right.
You know, and I want to be accurate or precise now, so I would like to ask you to translate what should I say about this, because I'm not sure that I've made it good enough on my very broken English. Ideja je, znači jasno je, čovjek koji je unio oružje u salu Borik, unio ga je 2008. godine. 2008. Ne. To oružje koje je nađeno, unešeno je 2008. godine. Ironija je u tome da je to oružje koje potiče iz Bosanskog rata.
Okay, so the ammunition and the weapons and the explosives which were taken into this building, they were produced in 2008.
Unio ga je u salu.
Aha, he'd already taken them into that building. So they'd been there for 3 or 4
yes,
years.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
So this all this stuff lay undiscovered.
Šta se dalje desilo? Proslava 20-godišnjice državnosti Republike Srpske održana je u toj sali 2012. Znači 4 godine nakon što je uneseno oružje.
Yeah. 4 years later the celebrations were to be held in this building. Yeah.
I onda se desilo sljedeće. Oni su našli to oružje i počeli da spinuju. Prvo je bila priča da su Iranci namjeravali da izvrše atentat nad okupljenim ljudima, pa su onda bili neki drugi muslimani i tako dalje i tako dalje.
Okay, so the explosives and weapons were found, it seems, not long before the celebrations in January 2012, and then a whole gamut of stories and versions was promoted in the press about it possibly being Iranians or other Islamic terrorists.
Tako da je za mene čitava priča od početka bilo jasno bila laž. Mm-hmm. I kao laž sam je i tretirao.
So it was clear to Andrej from the very beginning that this was a lie, a construction, fabrication, and he treated it as such from
moj
the very
odgovor,
beginning.
Moj odgovor na tu laž je bio brutalni sarkazam.
Mm-hmm. His answer to that lie, to that manipulation, was brutal sarcasm.
Odgovor države Srbije koja je spinovala tu priču je bila medijska hajka na moju malenkost.
And the answer of the Serbian authorities, interestingly, in Serbia itself, more than Republika Srpska, was sort of a witch hunt against Andrej.
No, Republika Srpska just told that they should hunt me, like hunt me and kill me like Bin Laden. Nothing more than that.
Yes, and you had death threats
yeah,
and
course.
Were under police protection for a time at least.
And in the kraju čovjek je pušten, optužnice nema, a ovaj...
And ultimately this fellow was let free and was not charged.
Tako da tekst zapravo uopšte nije bio kontroverzan. Ono što je kontroverzno je bila sama ta laž i pokušaj spinovanja.
So in retrospect the case wasn't controversial at all. What was controversial or is the way Andrej was treated, the way it was blown up into some huge affair to compromise you in a way. But what I was wanting to ask is, you said that if this guy had detonated the explosives in the hall at that time during the celebrations, that would have been a civilizational step forward.
Yeah, that's sarcasm.
And, yeah, it's definitely sarcasm. And if he had done it as a frustrated Serbian worker who'd realized, okay, I'm an ethnic Serb, but I've been ripped off by the politicians and by the entrepreneurs in this quasi-state. And I wanted to make a bridge back to the coming, because one of the theories of the murder is that it was committed by a very frustrated, impoverished worker who's portrayed in the book. Now, is Lazar in any way related for you at a sort of a mental level, at a level of ideas with the guy in Banja Luka?
Yes, in a way, but Lazar itself is more like a character from Dostoevsky, you know, because he's the thing, the murder he's done is not the act of class awareness or anything like that. There is no revolutionary potential in that act of violence. He's jealous, and he is ne može oprostiti familiji na dobru koje mu je učinilo.
Mm. He can't. The family who employed him out of generosity, he can't forgive them this generosity. He won't allow them to show this to him.
That's more Dostoevsky than Marx. That's my point.
Dostoevsky meets Marx in this book. It's very, very good that Slava Žižek also commented on this book, describing it as an explosive mixture of hard-boiled investigation, a story of impending global catastrophe, and description of daily life in a small Balkan city. It strikes me as being very accurate because there are all of those levels. I wouldn't mind reading another short extract. Do you have anything to say at this point?
No, but then I think afterwards, I think Andrej is kind enough to answer your question. So after
yes, of course.
This reading.
All right, I'm just going to read 2 and a bit pages, it's not long, from chapter 5, where we meet another inhabitant of Ulcin called Salvatore. Salvatore finished his story. He sat there with his elbow on his knee and fist on his chin, staring into the emptiness before him. He stayed like that in silence for a while, like Rodin's thinker who'd just reached the end of all thoughts. I thought I saw tears in his eyes, but Salvatore was a tough guy. He jumped to his feet, downed his, or rather my, whiskey, and said in a very businesslike manner, "So that's agreed then?" Like everyone who approaches me, Salvatore didn't trust the police, and quite justifiably so, because even if the police found the killer, his tracks could be covered again for the right price. If the police failed to protect the felon in any way, there was always the court. The criminal could rely on its corruptibility, even if the case he'd paid to cover up was taken all the way to the Supreme Court. Salvatore therefore wanted me to find the killer. "You're a wreck of a man. You don't need anything anymore. You don't want anything anymore, not even money. I can trust you," he told me. I took that as a compliment. "I'll think about it," I said. "You'll do it, I know," he smiled and shook my hand. Salvatore's story, his son has just been murdered. That's the background to this Salvatore guy coming to the detective. Salvatore's story didn't surprise me because he'd been dogged by misfortune all his life. His first and greatest misfortune was to be born in this country. As with the majority of things which cause us lifelong suffering, he had his parents to thank. We are all victims of our parents' inability to resist the reproductive urge. We've all been at the receiving end of the fascism of nature, whose casualty count far surpasses that of any criminal regime or system we've seen, and every single one of them has been criminal. Instead of pictures of Hitler and Stalin, textbooks which teach school children about the greatest enemies of humankind should show a picture of a forest in spring. His parents went one step further in crime against their son. They decided to raise him in this country. Salvatore's father, Simone, had been stationed in Ulzin when fascist Italy fell. Enchanted by the natural beauty of the town, and even more by the beauty of its women, one of whom would later become his wife, this cheerful and ever primped up stereotype Italian decided to stay on. They say he left an olfactory trail of hair grease and aftershave behind him, so that when you went downtown, you'd always know where he'd been that morning. He came to Ulzin as an occupier and ended up as the object of town jokesters and the jealousy of many a husband. Simone lived in Ulzin more or less peacefully. What occasional bother he had was mainly of his own making, at least up until the Trieste crisis. Then anti-Italian demonstrations were organized throughout the country. Party leaders came from Podgorica to ensure that the spontaneous expression of popular rage in Ulzin went off according to plan. One of them heard there was an Italian living in the town. The people of Ulzin said in Simone's defense that he was good-natured, a harmless clown, whose only flaw was being a Casanova. But the comrades from Podgorica were unyielding. Simone was Italian, therefore he was suspicious and had to be punished. And punished he was. He had to march at the head of the demonstrations and carry the biggest "Trieste is ours" placard. Him, of all people. One of the nice little sort of implants in the story. Detail, humorous, but serious at the same time. Brilliant. I'm sure someone has a question or two to ask.
Why did Montenegro lose its independence?
Sorry?
Why did Montenegro lose its independence?
It loses its independence in 1918. Mainly because it lost the war, you know. King Nicholas' army was defeated, and King Nicholas was forced to move first to Italy, I think, and then to France. And after that, Serbian army came to Montenegro, and then the people spontaneously declared unity with Serbia. From Serbian perspective, it's the regular act of
unification.
And from our Montenegrin perspective, it was absolutely illegal and kind of an occupation of Montenegro. Anyway, during the communist regime, better days came for Montenegro, and as Badinter Committee found at the very beginning of the war in former Yugoslavia, every Yugoslav republic had a right to become independent state, which Montenegro became in 2006.
There was a question at the back, I think.
Andre, if you can just share with us what winning the European Prize for Literature meant for you personally, and also how do you find yourself in your role as the cultural advisor in the parliament, or the parliament of Montenegro?
And free society. I wanted to know what. How do you teach somebody free society?
Well, you have to ask my employer.
What do they ask you? That's the question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the idea is of course to. It is of course only a society, but we wanted to underline that it should be free. So it's not that we claim that society in Montenegro is not free or is not free enough, but that the only acceptable society is a free society. And that was something we talked about, and we weren't sure about that title, but finally President Krivokapić decided that it should be. And for the European Union Prize for Literature, of course, it was a great thing for me because Montenegrin language is, in numbers, very small language. So any chance to be translated, and the point of the European Prize for Literature is that it ensures authors to be, well, translated in at least very few European languages. So that kind of a chance is something that you... Anyway, I could only dream about that, you know, because I lived, and I still live in Ulcinj. It is a very small seaside town at the very end of the Montenegro and the very end of the world in many things, you know. So I never really planned, you know, to fly to London and read to you and speak to you. So, I mean, thanks to many things, among others, a European Union Prize for Literature, it happened.
Was there a question here? No? Okay, please.
Could I ask you whether the process of being translated made you think about the book at the end of that process any differently?
Well, I wasn't really into that process because I read first a few chapters of Will Works and I have no... Permit me.
You had no negative comments about
That was a wonderful work. So, in a way, it was. I think it was inappropriate to. Excuse me.
But was the question more about whether knowing it was going to be translated influenced the way he wrote?
No. Having it translated, did your sort of presumably you read some of the English? Whether that showed you something about. The novel that you haven't thought about in your own language?
Well, actually, yes. In many parts of novel, and especially in which is very strange, in sentences, I feel it more than anything else. Because, of course, I read it on English and then translate it to Montenegrin, and it's not always the same thing I have written. I mean, the translation is good, but I can see differences in languages, you know, and I can understand all those shades, all those things that don't really think about them when you are writing in your own language. But I usually read only a theory in English. I'm not really capable to read a good fiction or, and especially not good poetry in English. So probably my own book is the only book I can read in English.
You do listen to English-speaking pop music and rock music, don't you? And you understand that. So that's the common denominator as well. There were two questions there. And you too? Yeah?
Just my first point was because first I was very shocked when I heard the name, and I just want to know how Montenegrins came to claim the benefits out of your success. Because, see, I'm born in Montenegro, but whenever people ask me, I say, I'm born in Yugoslavia, and I'm Yugoslavia, even if Yugoslavia doesn't exist, because I live on the road, I've been here for 30 years. To me, this like everywhere. But then I heard your name, Andrej Nikolić, because I'm Stojan Radulic.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was born in Komani, Montenegro, but I live on the road all the time. So I just want to know that connection, because I know politics is very trendy in Balkans and always make the things up because of... I don't like to go very often and then I go and talk to people, talk to... See, I did some work with Terry Pratchett a couple of years ago and I'm very much involved in music. But certain things, I know people from the government and everything which I don't like going back in the past, like giving my title as name. I don't like giving your name.
Okay, but...
In 89, give it...
Okay, but here is the story. Nikolaidis' family came to Ulcinj,
okay.
And today Ulcinj is in Montenegro, at the very end of 19th century, even before it was a part of Montenegro. So obviously, my family is very, very long, for a very long time in Montenegro. My father was born in Montenegro. Both my grandfathers were, I mean, Nikola died in Montenegro, and the other guy, his name was Lubarda, which is, yes, and my grandfather was, grandmother was Vukmanović from Crvenica. So obviously, I qualified as Montenegrin.
Yeah. We have two more questions, and then I think also we have to slowly wrap it up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us what you think about Angelina Jolie's new
film. Actually, didn't see it. I took it on DVD, I think it could be good, you know. I don't have any prejudices on, and I think lots of bad critiques on that movie came from the fact that she's an actress and she's beautiful, you know. And I really want to see that movie with very good intention.
Mm-hmm. I have two. Susan, you wanted a question? Then you and you maybe? Yeah. Two more and then, yeah.
They really translate you in English. You translate from English some things like Noam Chomsky.
Yep. Only theory.
How you think? Is this integral part of your intellectual behavior, intellectual person? First and second is about this your polemics about this celebration. There was negative reaction also in Montenegro, very negative reaction. What do you think about this?
We all live in English language. You can't really escape from English even if you want to. So that's it. It's part of all of us. If we have a computer or even TV, we live with English language. So that's clear. And the political scene in Montenegro is very... First of all, I have lots of enemies in Montenegro. So they were more than willing to grab me for that article. They thought they have a good case, you know. At the very end, it turns out that it was only a spin, only a fiction, which a few guys did in order to win the elections in Serbia. So, but I will kill myself if I help Boris Tadić to win the elections.
And actually, my question is on that point that you actually made. Have the death threats affected you in any way on how outspoken you are?
I can't really remember when I got my first death threat, but that was, I think, 15 years ago, and I'm still alive. So, obviously, the people who are threatening you are not serious. I'm afraid of those who don't speak, you know. When the thing goes public and when there is a lot of rage and a lot of noise, I think the one is pretty safe in that situation. Obviously, you don't have to go to roadhouse restaurants, you know, you don't have to go to concerts at the time when you are on the cover of magazines, when people are claiming that you are a supporter of terrorism, or even worse than that, that you are a terrorist. But that's the point. As a writer, as a public person, even in Balkans, you are protected in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be afraid of the people who don't yell, you know, who don't really use media to send messages.
I think, maybe one last question and then...
Yes, of course.
Because it's so interesting.
I'm from Vienna, from Austria. I'd just like to know, you don't have to answer to the question, but have you been living in Austria, or is it just fiction?
No, I was in Austria for 7 days. Only for 7 days, and I
in Vienna, and
I described that hotel I was in and the buildings surrounding the hotel. That's where I place that's Carlton Opera Hotel, and that's where I place my character. You know.
Okay, so 7 days. So, that's quite impressive, I guess.
Okay, but that's not the point. But I read 10 Thomas Bernhardt's novel. I mean.
Yeah, I've read anyone.
So I guess that afterwards you can exchange on Thomas Bernhardt. I think there's still a glass.
I think first there's
Yeah. So thank you very much, André. Thank you very
thank
much,
you.
Will, for this very lively and interesting conversation. Thank you, I suppose, also. I'm a bit hesitant to say it because I'm not really the host. I'm only an invited host. So thanks to the embassy. And to the publisher for this very lovely evening, bringing Montenegrin literature and politics and feelings and societal matters to the Europe House. That was very, very nice. Thank you very much. And if you want to know what the Opera Carlton Hotel looks like in the book, here you go. And the copies are available there on sale. So good luck for your future days.
Thank you very much.
Relax, get here slowly, and you know, I wish you all the best, and I think on behalf of everybody here present, thank you.
Thank you.
Hoćeš se poslužiti vinom?
Hoću, ali ovaj engleski moram da vježbam, mogu mi da nekad se umorim.
E, imaćeš priliku.
Onda počnem.
Hi. Samo
malo sam. Skrinjavu.